stream, you'll need to convince investors to give you money, and it's much harder to raise money from investors for a calculated gamble, blitzscaling, than for a sure thing, fast scaling. To make matters worse, you usually need more money to blitzscale than to fast scale because you have to keep enough capital in reserve to recover from the many mistakes you're likely to make along the way. Yet despite all of these potential pitfalls, blitzscaling remains a powerful tool for entrepreneurs and other business leaders. If you're willing to accept the risks of blitzscaling when others aren't, you'll be able to move faster than they will if the prize to be won is big enough and the competition to win it is intense enough. Blitzscaling becomes a rational, even optimal strategy. Once you convince the market for capital and the market for talent, which includes clients and partners as well as employees, to invest in your scale-up, you have the fuel required to start blitzscaling. At that point, your objective switches from going from 0 to 1 to going from 1 to 1 billion in an incredibly compressed time frame. A company might employ different types of scaling at different points in its life cycle. The canonical sequence that companies like Google and Facebook have gone through begins with classic startup growth while establishing product market fit, then shifts into blitzscaling to achieve critical mass and or market dominance ahead of the competition, then relaxes down to fast scaling as the business matures, and finally downshifts to classic scale-up growth when the company is an established industry leader. Together, this sequence of scaling generates a classic S-curve of growth, with slower initial growth followed by rapid acceleration, eventually easing its way into a gentle plateau. Of course, this canonical sequence is greatly simplified. The scaling cycle applies not just to whole companies, but to individual products and business lines. The aggregate curves of these scaling cycles generate the overall scaling curve for the company. This audiobook includes a PDF of the various graphs and charts that appear in the book. When we come upon a graph or chart that you may wish to reference, I'll let you know about it so you can look it up in your PDF. For example, Facebook began as a classic blitzscaling story. The year-over-year revenue growth during its first few years of existence were 2,150%, 433%, and 219%, going from $0 to $153 million in revenue in 2007. Then the company went through a key transition, and growth dropped into the double-digit range as Facebook struggled with both monetization and the shift from desktop to mobile. Fortunately, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg made two important moves. He personally led a shift from desktop first to mobile first, and he hired Sheryl Sandberg as the company's COO, who in turn built Facebook into an advertising sales juggernaut. Growth rose back into the triple-digit range, and by 2010, these moves had pushed Facebook's revenues to over $2 billion. We'll examine both of these key moves in greater detail later in the book, with Facebook's shift to mobile featured in our analysis of Facebook's business model, and Facebook's hiring of Sheryl Sandberg in the section on the key transition from contributors to managers to executives. Apple illustrates how this overlap looks over multiple decades. In its storied history, Apple went through complete scaling cycles for the Apple II, the Macintosh, the iMac, and the iPod, with the cycle for the iPhone still underway. It's worth noting that Apple failed to launch any blitzscalable products after the Apple II and the Mac until Steve Jobs returned and launched the iMac, iPod, and iPhone. It was part of Steve's rare genius that time and time again, he was able to pick the right product for Apple to blitzscale, even without slowing down for a period of classic startup growth to gather feedback from the market. The scaling curve applies to every blitzscaler, regardless of industry or geography. The same multiple S curve that describes Facebook or Apple also describes Tencent, which launched with QQ, then added a second curve for WeChat after QQ reached maturity in 2010. Just when you're finished blitzscaling one business line, you need to blitzscale the next to maintain your company's upward trajectory. And as blitzscaling continues to spread, established companies with mature business lines should consider turning to intrapreneurs to blitzscale new business units. The three basics of blitzscaling. Blitzscaling requires you to move at a pace that is almost certainly uncomfortable for your team. You will definitely make many mistakes as you navigate an environment full of uncertainty. The art lies in developing the skill to learn quickly from those mistakes and return to a relentlessly rapid advance. But first, it's critical to understand three basics. 1. Blitzscaling is both an offensive strategy and a defensive strategy. On offense, blitzscaling allows you to do several things. First, you can take the market by surprise, bypassing heavily defended niches to exploit breakout opportunities. For example, Slack's rapid growth after its launch blindsided a host of entrenched competitors like Microsoft and Salesforce.com. Second, you can leverage your lead to build long-term competitive advantages before other players are able to respond. We'll explore this concept in greater detail later on. Third, blitzscaling opens up access to capital because investors generally prefer to back market leaders. You can win this mantle if you blitzscale, and with it, raise more money more easily and more quickly than your lagging competitors. On defense, blitzscaling lets you set a pace that keeps your competitors gasping simply to keep up, affording them little time and space to counterattack. Because they're focused on responding to your moves, which can often take them by surprise and force them to play catch-up, they don't have as much time available to develop and execute differentiated strategies that might threaten your position. Blitzscaling helps you determine the playing field to your great advantage. 2. Blitzscaling thrives on positive feedback loops in that the company that grows to scale first reaps significant competitive advantages. In April 2014, McKinsey & Company published a report entitled Grow Fast or Die Slow, which analyzed the life cycles of 3,000 software and internet companies and found that positive feedback loops made rapid growth the key factor in financial success. First, growth yields greater returns. High-growth companies offer a return to shareholders 5 times greater than medium-growth companies. Second, growth predicts long-term success. Supergrowers, companies whose growth was greater than 60% when they reached $100 million in revenues, were 8 times more likely to reach $1 billion in revenues than those growing less than 20%. We believe that the mechanism behind the power of blitzscaling is first scaler advantage. Once a scale-up occupies the high ground in its ecosystem, the networks around it recognize its leadership and both talent and capital flood in. For one, top professionals understand that they can have a greater impact working for the market leader. Meanwhile, joining a scale-up that is clearly a rocket ship offers many of the financial rewards of working for an early-stage startup with far more certainty and far less risk. Scale-up employees are paid market salaries, receive equity upside, and have a very good chance of becoming rich, if not filthy rich. By attracting the best people, scale-ups increase their ability to build and bring to market great products, which in turn increases their ability to rapidly scale. A parallel calculus applies to investors. Venture capitalists, VCs, make investment decisions based on the confidence interval they have in their investment thesis. Achieving scale shrinks those intervals and makes it easier to decide to invest. And because the network that connects investors, especially within a tight-knit ecosystem like Silicon Valley, can disseminate this information quickly and broadly, a blitzscaling company can raise capital on a massive scale. This capital infusion can fuel explosive growth, which shrinks the confidence intervals even further. Paradoxically, globalization has both leveled the playing field for entrepreneurs around the world and increased the value of being in a premier scaling hub like Silicon Valley or China. Because the rest of the world believes that these ecosystems have an advantage in scaling up startups, those startups and their investors attract capital, human and financial, from all over the world, further bolstering their ability to keep growing. This is a key reason why scale-ups like Uber and Pinterest have achieved a scale and valuation that dwarf those of most publicly traded companies. Due to my role at Greylock Partners, I can't comment on the valuations of Dropbox and Airbnb, but they occupy a similar place in the ecosystem. Consider the case of two very similar companies, Twitter and Tumblr. Both had brilliant product-oriented founders in Ev Williams, and David Karp. Both were hot social media startups. Both grew at a remarkable rate after establishing product-market fit. Both had a major impact on popular culture. Yet Twitter went public and achieved a market capitalization that peaked at nearly $37 billion, while Tumblr was acquired by Yahoo, another startup that used blitzscaling to become a scale-up, only to decline and fade away, for only $1 billion. Was this dumb luck on Twitter's side? Perhaps. Luck always plays a larger role than founders, investors, and the media would like to admit. But a major difference was that Twitter could draw on numerous networks for advice and help that Tumblr could not. For example, Twitter was able to bring in Dick Costolo, a savvy executive with prior scaling experience at Google. In contrast, even though Tumblr was arguably the most prominent startup in its New York City ecosystem, it couldn't easily draw upon a pool of local talent who had experience dealing with rapid growth. According to Greylock's John Lilly, for every executive role that Tumblr needed to fill, there were less than a handful of candidates in all of New York City. This paucity of talent made hiring difficult. The company was reluctant to replace existing employees due to a lack of better alternatives. Without the ability to hire an executive team that could blitzscale, Tumblr decided to sell the company. Of course, while geography can present challenges to blitzscaling, they become much more solvable if you're aware of them. For example, over the past decade, Priceline, the world's most successful online travel company, has been able to blitzscale from its headquarters in Connecticut. The CEO who led Priceline during its growth phase, Jeffrey Boyd, saw advantages to this geographic isolation, noting that the company's location meant that it faced fewer bidding wars for the key software engineers and designers needed to support the rapid growth of the business. It's extremely difficult for later entrants to compete directly with a blitzscaling company that has first scaler advantage. Unless these players find a different game in which they can capture this advantage, they'll simply become irrelevant. 3. Despite its incredible advantages and potential payoffs, blitzscaling also comes with massive risks. Until recently, move fast and break things was Facebook's famous motto. Yet rapid growth can cause nearly as many problems as it solves. As Mark Zuckerberg told me in an interview for my Masters of Scale podcast, "We got to a point where it was taking us more time to go back and fix the bugs and issues that we're creating than the speed we were gaining by going faster." In one famous incident, a summer intern introduced a bug that brought down the entire Facebook site for 30 minutes. There is a scientific term for out-of-control growth in the human body: cancer. In this context, uncontrolled growth is clearly undesirable. The same is true for a business. Successful blitzscaling means that you're maintaining at least some level of control by rapidly fixing the things that will inevitably get broken, so that the company can maintain its furious pace without flaming out or collapsing in on itself. Like an American football player streaking down the field for a game-winning touchdown, even a company that has achieved first scaler advantage can lose the ball prior to crossing the goal line if it takes on a bigger risk than it can handle. Blitzscaling is risky from a management perspective as well. Reinventing your leadership style, your product, and your organization at every new phase of scale won't be easy, but it is necessary. In the words of leadership guru Marshall Goldsmith, "What got you here won't get you there." Market share and revenue growth earn headlines, but you can't achieve customer and revenue scale without scaling up your organization in terms of the size and scope of your staff, as well as your financial, product, and technology strategy. If the organization doesn't grow in lockstep with its revenues and customer base, things can quickly spiral out of control. For example, during a period of blitzscaling in the late 1980s and early 1990s, Oracle Corporation focused so single-mindedly on sales growth that its organization lagged badly on both technology, where it fell behind arch-rival Sybase, and finance, and nearly went bankrupt as a result. It took the turnaround efforts of Ray Lane and Jeff Henley to stave off disaster and reposition Oracle for its later success. Blitzscaling your organization will require hard choices and sacrifices. For example, the people who are adept at launching a company aren't necessarily going to be the right people to scale it, as the Oracle example demonstrates. Later in the book, we'll discuss how successful blitzscalers consciously manage growth rather than letting it manage them. The 5 stages of blitzscaling. Blitzscaling a startup isn't a linear process. A global giant isn't simply a startup that's been multiplied by 1,000 working out of a gleaming high-rise headquarters instead of a grimy garage. Each major increment of growth represents a qualitative as well as quantitative change. Drew Houston of Dropbox expressed this well when he told me, "The chessboard keeps adding new pieces and new dimensions over time." In the physical sciences, materials often undergo phase changes as their circumstances, e.g., temperature and pressure, change. Ice melts into water, water boils into steam. As a startup scales up from one phase to the next, it undergoes fundamental changes as well. And in the same way that ice skates are useless on water, and you can't skip rocks on water vapor, the approaches and processes that work for one phase break down once the scale-up reaches the next phase. This book is designed to help you successfully navigate the phase changes you'll face on the path to global dominance. Throughout this book, we will refer to the five key stages of blitzscaling using the metaphor of a community. Since the most obvious, visible, and impactful change in a scale-up is the number of people it employs, we'll define the stages based on the number of employees in the company, or its organizational scale. I'm going to read through a chart that describes the five stages of blitzscaling, but you can also find this chart in the included PDF. The five stages of blitzscaling. Stage 1. Family. 1 to 9 employees. Stage 2. Tribe. Tens of employees. Stage 3. Village. Hundreds of employees. Stage 4. City. Thousands of employees. Stage 5. Nation. Tens of thousands of employees. Each stage has critical differences when it comes to management and leadership. When you're the head of a nuclear family, you have close relationships with all of your family members. When you're the head of a whole nation, you're responsible for the lives of a multitude of people, most of whom you'll never meet. Later in this book, we'll talk about how to optimize your people management strategy as your company grows. It's important to remember that while these powers of 10 provide a clear and consistent set of categories, real life is often messier. For example, a startup with a tight-knit team might feel and act like a family even if it has nearly 20 employees, so these definitions are meant simply to offer a useful set of guidelines. We also recognize that the number of employees is only one of several measures of an organization's scale. Some of the other measures of scale include the number of users, user scale, the number of customers, customer scale, and the total annual revenues, business scale. These measures usually, but don't always, move in lockstep. While it's nearly impossible to achieve customer scale or business scale without organizational scale, customers require customer service representatives, and revenues typically require salespeople, it is possible to achieve user scale without organizational scale. Consider the example of Instagram. When that company was acquired by Facebook for $1 billion, it had over 100 million users, but just 13 employees and no significant revenues. The fact that the phases don't always move in lockstep is a feature of blitzscaling, not a bug. As we'll discuss, operational scalability is one of the primary growth limiters that scale-ups need to address. When a business can grow users, customers, and revenues faster than the number of employees without collapsing under the weight of its own growth, the business can achieve greater profitability and keep growing without being as tightly constrained by the need for financial or human capital. In contrast, when the number of employees grows faster than users, customers, and revenues, it's a major red flag that could indicate issues with the fundamental business model. Nevertheless, for the sake of simplicity, this book will typically define the stage of a company by its organizational scale. A family stage company will have 1 to 9 employees, a tribe stage company will have 10 to 99 employees, and so on. When exceptions arise, we'll specifically call them out to avoid confusion. The three key techniques of blitzscaling. Through much study of, direct access to, and conversation with the leadership at companies such as Google, Amazon, and Facebook, and through my own experiences as an entrepreneur and an investor, we've been able to identify the three key techniques applied by entrepreneurs and investors to build dominant companies. These basic principles do not depend on geography and can be adapted to build great companies in any ecosystem, albeit with varying degrees of difficulty. Technique number 1. Business model innovation. The first technique of blitzscaling is to design an innovative business model that can truly grow. This sounds like a startup's 101 level insight, but it's astounding how many founders miss this key element. A major mistake made by many startups around the world is focusing on the technology, the software, the product, and the design, but neglecting to ever figure out the business. And by business, we simply mean how the company makes money by acquiring and serving its customers. In contrast, despite the popular "engineers are gods" narrative prevalent in Silicon Valley, the companies and founders we universally hail as geniuses aren't just technology nerds, they're almost always business nerds too. At Google, Larry Page and Sergey Brin built great search algorithms, but it was their innovations to the search engine business model, specifically considering relevance and performance when displaying advertisements rather than simply renting space to the highest bidder, that drove their massive success. As the world has gone digital, business model innovation has become even more important. So many technologies are available as services, which are on demand and built to be integrated, that technology is no longer as strong a differentiator. While figuring out the right combinations of services to bring together into a breakthrough product has become a major differentiator. Most of today's successful companies are more like Tesla, which combines a set of technologies that already existed, rather than SpaceX, which had to pioneer new ones. Business model innovation is how startups are able to outcompete established competitors who typically hold a host of advantages over any startups. As a startup, Dropbox competes with giants like Microsoft and Google, who ought to have major advantages in technology, finance, and market power. Dropbox founder and CEO, Drew Houston, knows that his company can't simply rely on better technology or out-executing the competition. If your playbook is the same as your competitors, you are in trouble, because chances are they are just going to run your playbook with a lot more resources. Drew had to design a better business model in which the focus on sharing files means that the number of files Dropbox has to store, or in the past, pay Amazon to store, increases far more slowly than the value created for the customer, and thus the revenues Dropbox can collect from those customers. Uber and Airbnb also built large businesses at incredible speed based on novel business models rather than unprecedented new technologies. If technological innovation alone were enough, federal research labs would produce $100 billion companies on a regular basis. Spoiler alert, they don't. This is not to say that technology innovation is unimportant. Technology innovation is the most common trigger for launching a new market or upending an existing one. Uber wasn't the first company to try to improve the experience of hailing a taxi, but prior to the technological innovation of the smartphone, complete with wireless internet connection and GPS-enabled location-based services, Uber's business model simply wouldn't have worked. These innovations reduced the friction for both driver and rider, making Uber's core UberX ride-sharing model a mass-market possibility for the first time. Nor can companies afford to ignore technology innovation after they successfully blitzscale their way to city or nation stage. Each and every one of the technology companies worth over $100 billion has used technology leadership to reinforce its competitive advantages. Amazon may have started as a simple online retailer with no unique technology, but today its technological prowess in cloud computing, automated logistics, and voice recognition help to maintain its dominance. In fact, the mega companies built by blitzscaling are often the ones buying the technology innovators, much as Google bought DeepMind and Facebook bought Oculus. Technology innovation is a key factor in retaining the gains produced by business model innovation. After all, if one technology innovation can create a new market, another technology innovation can render it obsolete, seemingly overnight. While Uber has achieved massive scale, the greatest threat to its future doesn't come in the form of direct competitors like Didi Chuxing, though these are formidable threats. The greatest threat to Uber's business is the technology innovation of autonomous vehicles, which could make obsolete one of Uber's biggest competitive advantages, its carefully cultivated network of drivers, essentially overnight. The key is to combine new technologies with effective distribution to potential customers, a scalable and high-margin revenue model, and an approach that allows you to serve those customers given your probable resource constraints. Ideally, you design your business model innovation before you start your company. This is what happened when I co-founded LinkedIn. The key business model innovations for LinkedIn, including the two-way nature of the relationships and filling professionals' need for a business-oriented online identity, didn't just happen organically. They were the result of much thought and reflection, and I drew on the experiences I had when founding SocialNet, one of the first online social networks, nearly a decade before the creation of LinkedIn. But life isn't always so neat. Many companies, even famous and successful ones, have to develop their business model innovation after they have already commenced operations. PayPal didn't have a business model when it began operations. I was a key member of the PayPal executive team. We were growing exponentially at 5% per day, and we were losing money on every single transaction we processed. The funny thing is that some of our critics called us insane for paying customers bonuses to refer their friends. Those referral bonuses were actually brilliant because their cost was so much lower than the standard cost of acquiring new financial services customers via advertising. We'll discuss the power and importance of this kind of viral marketing later on. The insanity, in fact, was that we were allowing our users to accept credit card payments, sticking PayPal with the cost of paying 3% of each transaction to the credit card processors, while charging our users nothing. I remember once telling my old college friend and PayPal co-founder and CEO, Peter Thiel, "Peter, if you and I were standing on the roof of our office and throwing stacks of $100 bills off the edge as fast as our arms could go, we still wouldn't be losing money as quickly as we are right now." We ended up solving the problem by charging businesses to accept payments, much as the credit card processors did, but funding those payments using automated clearinghouse, ACH, bank transactions, which cost a fraction of the charges associated with the credit card networks. But if we had waited until we had solved this problem before blitzscaling, I suspect we wouldn't have become the market leader. Technique number two, strategy innovation. The most obvious element of blitzscaling is the pursuit of extreme growth, which, when combined with an innovative business model, can generate massive value and long-term competitive advantage. Many startups believe they are pursuing a strategy of extreme growth when in fact they have the goal and the wish for extreme growth, but no understanding of an actual strategy that will get them there. To achieve your goals, you have to know what you plan to do, and just as important, what you plan not to do. Also, growth doesn't create value in and of itself. For that, it has to be paired with a working business model. It's easy to achieve extreme customer and revenue growth if your company sells $20 bills for $1, but we'll make it up in volume, won't allow you to build any sustainable value. For successful blitzscaling, the competitive advantage comes from the growth factors built into the business model, such as network effects, whereby the first company to achieve critical scale triggers a feedback loop that allows it to dominate a winner-take-all or winner-take-most market and achieve a lasting first-scaler advantage. For example, Uber's strategy of aggressive city-by-city expansion allows its customers to hail rides with fewer delays than its competitors. Uber wants you to be able to get a ride faster with Uber than with anyone else. This attracts more customers, which attracts more drivers, which increases the liquidity of the marketplace, which allows customers to hail rides even more quickly, which attracts more customers, and so on. Early Uber investor Bill Gurley laid out Uber's strategy in his 2012 blog post, "All Markets Are Not Created Equal." As the company grows, they are able to facilitate more cars on the road, and along with their investment in route and load optimization, this allows for shorter and shorter pickup times. The experience gets better and better the longer they are in the market. Blitzscaling goes beyond just a strategy of aggressive growth because it involves doing things that don't make sense according to traditional business thinking, such as prioritizing speed over efficiency despite an uncertain environment. At the same time, blitzscaling also goes beyond just risk-taking. It may be risky to bet the company, as Walt Disney did when he borrowed against his own life insurance to build Disneyland, but it's not blitzscaling. Blitzscaling would have involved inefficiencies like paying construction crews to work 24 hours a day in order to get Disneyland open a few months earlier, or reducing ticket prices 90% to get to 1 million visitors faster, knowing that those 1 million visitors were networked to 10 million more. Here is one of the ruthless practices that has helped make Silicon Valley so successful. Investors will look at a company that is on an upward trajectory but doesn't display the proverbial hockey stick of exponential growth and conclude that they need to either sell the business or take on additional risk that might increase the chances of achieving exponential growth. Achieving 20% annual growth, which would delight Wall Street analysts covering any other industry, simply isn't enough to transform a startup into a multi-billion dollar company fast enough. Silicon Valley venture capitalists want entrepreneurs to pursue exponential growth, even if doing so costs more money and increases the chances that the business could fail, resulting in a bigger loss. Dropping below even 40% annual growth is a warning sign for investors. This mindset can be difficult for people to understand. Why should I risk it all and potentially blow up what is a successful, growing business, they might rightfully ask. The answer is that blitzscaling businesses tend to play in winner-take-most or winner-take-all markets. The greater risk for a successful, growing business is to move too slowly and allow its competitors to win market leadership and first-scaler advantage. Nokia is a great example of the cost of caution. In 2007, Nokia was the world's largest and most successful maker of mobile phones with a market capitalization of just under $99 billion. Then Apple and Samsung came blazing into the market. In 2013, Nokia sold its money-losing handset operations to Microsoft for $7 billion. And in 2016, Microsoft sold its feature phone assets and the Nokia handset brand to Foxconn and HMD for just $350 million. That's a drop in value for Nokia's mobile phone business from somewhere in the neighborhood of $99 billion to $350 million in less than a decade, a decline of over 99%. At the time, Nokia's decisions may have seemed to make sense. Nokia actually continued growing even after the launch of the iPhone and Google's Android operating system. Nokia hit its peak in terms of unit volume when it shipped 104 million phones in 2010. But Nokia sales declined after that and were surpassed by Android in 2011 and iPhone in 2012. By the time Nokia's management realized the existential threat facing them, it was too late. Even the desperation play of aligning themselves with Microsoft as its exclusive Windows phone partner couldn't reverse the decline. Because blitzscaling often requires spending significant amounts of capital in ways that traditional business wisdom would consider wasteful, implementing a financial strategy that supports this aggressive spending is a critical part of blitzscaling. For example, Uber often uses heavy subsidies on both sides of the marketplace when it launches in a new city, lowering fares to attract riders and boosting payments to attract drivers. By paying out more than it takes in on those early trips, Uber is able to reach critical scale faster than a more conservative competitor. Given the winner-take-most nature of the ride-sharing market, that wasteful spending has helped Uber achieve a dominant market position in the cities in which it operates. Of course, that strategy isn't possible without the ability to raise massive amounts of capital on favorable terms. In Uber's case, it has been able to raise nearly $9 billion between its founding and the writing of this book. At some point, Uber will have to demonstrate the ability to significantly improve its unit economics, or its investors will get very grumpy. This concern helps explain Uber's significant investments in autonomous vehicle technology, which could eliminate its biggest expense, driver payments, in one fell swoop. The willingness to take on the risks of blitzscaling is one of the major reasons why Silicon Valley has produced such a disproportionate share of blockbuster companies in comparison to other geographies. To be fair, it has also produced a disproportionate share of financial disasters, hence the word risk when talking about blitzscaling. But as the rise of juggernauts like Alibaba and Spotify illustrates, blitzscaling is also starting to take off around the world. Technique number 3, management innovation. The final technique required for blitzscaling is management innovation. This is necessary because of the extreme strains placed on the organization and its employees by hypergrowth. I'm fond of pointing out to entrepreneurs and executives that, in theory, you don't need practice. What I mean is that no matter how brilliant your business model and growth strategy, you won't be able to build a real-world, i.e., non-theoretical, blockbuster company without a lot of practice. But that problem is magnified when you're trying to blitzscale. The kind of growth involved in blitzscaling typically means major human resources challenges. Tripling the number of employees each year isn't uncommon for a blitzscaling company. This requires a radically different approach to management than that of a typical growth company, which would be happy to grow 15% a year and can take time finding a few perfect hires and obsessing about corporate culture. As we will discuss in more detail later in the book, companies that blitzscale have to rapidly navigate a set of key transitions as their organizations grow and have to embrace counterintuitive rules like hiring good enough people, launching flawed and imperfect products, letting fires burn, and ignoring angry customers. Over the course of this book, we'll see how business model, growth strategy, and management innovation work together to form the high-risk, high-reward process of blitzscaling. Part 2. Business Model Innovation. Of the three core techniques of blitzscaling, the first and most foundational is to design an innovative business model capable of exponential growth. The story of entrepreneurship in the internet era is a story of this kind of business model innovation. Think back to the dot-com era, which stretched roughly from the IPO of Netscape in 1995 until the NASDAQ began to crash in 2000. During this period, enormous numbers of startups and pretty much every established company tried to build great internet businesses, yet nearly all of them failed. The problem was, most of them simply tried to cut and paste existing business models onto the new online medium. You can't transplant a heart from one species into another and expect it to thrive. If you had asked stock market analysts in 1995 which companies were best positioned to dominate the internet, most would have pointed to existing giants like Microsoft and Time Warner, which invested millions in internet businesses like MSN and Pathfinder. Others would have mentioned pure-play dot-com startups like eToys, which combined proven business models like the Category Killer store with the new online medium. Yet, when the wreckage of the dot-com crash cleared, the most successful companies still charging full steam ahead were the few startups that were designed around totally new business models such as Amazon, eBay, and Google. Walmart should have dominated online retail, yet Amazon emerged and practically wrote the Bible for e-commerce, including consumer reviews, shopping carts, and free shipping. Newspapers and phone book companies should have been able to transfer their information businesses to the online world, but Yahoo and then Google stepped up to the plate. They built the search engines that index the world's information, and Google developed the business model that made it worth more than all traditional media companies combined. In contrast, and much to their misfortune, startups that relied purely on technology innovation without any real business model innovation largely went bust. Companies like eToys that tried to Amazon various markets, but without Amazon's front and back office innovations, crashed and burned once the financial markets began to demand profits rather than just expensive revenue growth. Even Netscape, whose Netscape Navigator mainstreamed web browsing and whose IPO kicked off the dot-com boom, was forced to sell itself off to AOL. Netscape engineers invented JavaScript, SSL, and all kinds of cool technology for the internet that are still used today, but Netscape accepted the status quo when it came to using tried and true business models, rather than developing new ones that were enabled by its own technology innovation. Unfortunately for Netscape, its competitor Microsoft already understood those business models all too well and knew exactly how to use its economic might and resources to pull their levers. In the first browser war, Microsoft pre-installed its Internet Explorer on all new Windows computers, then gave away its web server software, Internet Information Server, IIS, which effectively destroyed Netscape's business model. Could Netscape have succeeded with a different strategy? We believe so. Consider that one of the ways that Netscape monetized its Navigator browser was to sell the sponsorship of its Net Search button to the Excite search engine for $5 million. Netscape believed that the browser itself was the key, while search was simply a sideline. It was left to two pairs of Stanford graduate students, Jerry Yang and David Filo, Yahoo, and Larry Page and Sergey Brin, Google, to prove that search was a much bigger business. Google's innovative model of selling text ads next to search results via an automated marketplace allowed it to build a franchise so dominant that it later withstood a series of frontal assaults by Microsoft, including a marketing program in which Microsoft essentially paid people to use its Bing search engine. The same story has been repeated in multiple waves since. Facebook and LinkedIn dominate social networks, even though AOL, Microsoft, Hotmail, and Yahoo, Yahoo Mail, controlled most consumer online identities when those social networks first emerged. Alibaba beat eBay in China. Uber outflanked the taxi companies. Airbnb has more room listings than any hotel company in the world. These success stories are technology companies, sure. But as we've seen, technological innovation alone is insufficient, even when its impact on the future is huge. Services like Craigslist, Wikipedia, and IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, were early influential internet innovators, but they still never became massively, financially valuable on their own. The real value creation comes when innovative technology enables innovative products and services with innovative business models. Even though the business models of Google, Alibaba, and Facebook might seem obvious, even inevitable, after the fact, they weren't widely appreciated at the time they launched. How many people in 1999 would have realized that running tiny text ads next to the equivalent of an electronic card catalog would lead to the world's most valuable software company? Or that setting up an online shopping mall for China's emerging middle class would lead to a $100 billion business? Which of you in 2004 would have predicted that letting people see what their friends are talking about by staring at a tiny screen on a handheld computer would become the dominant form of media? Great companies and great businesses often seem to be bad ideas when they first appear because business model innovations, by their very definition, can't point to a proven business model to demonstrate why they'll work. To really understand why these business models succeed, we need to clearly define what we mean by business model in the first place. Part of the problem is that the term can be interpreted in so many different ways. The great management thinker Peter Drucker wrote that business models are essentially theories composed of assumptions about the business, which circumstances might require to change over time. Harvard Business School professor and author Clay Christensen believes that you need to focus on the concept of the job to be done. That is, when a customer buys a product, she is hiring it to do a particular job. Then there's Brian Chesky of Airbnb, who said simply, build a product people love. Hire amazing people. What else is there to do? Everything else is fake work. As Andrea Ovans aptly put it in her January 2015 Harvard Business Review article, What is a Business Model? It's enough to make your head swim. For the purposes of this book, we'll focus on the basic definition. A company's business model describes how it generates financial returns by producing, selling, and supporting its products. What sets companies like Amazon, Google, and Facebook apart, even from other successful high-tech companies, is that they have consistently been able to design and execute business models with characteristics that allow them to quickly achieve massive scale and sustainable competitive advantage. Of course, there isn't a single perfect business model that works for every company, and trying to find one is a waste of time. But most great business models have certain characteristics in common. If you want to find your best business model, you should try to design one that maximizes four key growth factors and minimizes two key growth limiters. Designing to maximize growth, the four growth factors. Growth factor number one, market size. The most basic growth factor to consider for your business model is market size. This focus on market size may sound obvious, and it's right out of Pitch Deck 101 for startups. But if you want to build a massive company, you need to begin with the basics and eliminate ideas that serve too small of a market. A big market has both a large number of potential customers and a variety of efficient channels for reaching those customers. That last point is important. A market consisting of everyone in the world might seem large, but it isn't reachable in any efficient way. We'll discuss this in greater depth when we look at distribution as a key growth factor. It's not easy to judge the size of a market, or what pitch decks and venture capitalists often refer to as TAM, total available market. Predicting TAM and how it will grow in the future is one of the main sources of uncertainty in blitzscaling. But predicting it correctly and investing accordingly when others are still paralyzed by fear is also one of the main opportunities for unexpectedly high returns, as we'll see in the cases of Airbnb and Uber. Ideally, the market itself is also growing quickly, which can make a smaller market attractive and a large market irresistible. In Silicon Valley, the competition for venture capital exerts a strong pressure on entrepreneurs to focus on ideas that are going after big markets. Venture capital firms might raise hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars from their investors, limited partners like pension funds and university endowments, who are seeking above-market returns to compensate them for taking a chance on privately held companies rather than simply investing in the Coca-Colas of the world. To deliver these above-market returns, venture capital funds need to at least triple their investors' money. A $100 million venture capital fund would need to return $300 million over the typical 7 to 10-year life of a fund to achieve an above-market internal rate of return of 15 to 22%. A $1 billion fund would need to return $3 billion. Since most venture capital investments either lose money or barely break even, the only realistic way that venture capitalists can achieve these aggressive goals is to rely on a small number of incredibly successful investments. For example, Benchmark Capital invested $6.7 million in eBay in 1997. Less than 2 years later, eBay went public and Benchmark's stake was worth $5 billion, which is a 745 times return. The specific fund that made that investment, Benchmark Capital Partners I, took $85 million from investors and returned $7.8 billion for a 92 times return. The initial investors in Facebook did even better, but were individuals rather than firms. Given the desire for home runs like eBay, most venture capitalists filter investment opportunities based on market size. If a company can't achieve venture scale, generally a market of at least $1 billion in annual sales, then most VCs won't invest, even if it is a good business. It simply isn't large enough to help them achieve their goal of returning more than three times their investors' money. When Brian Chesky was pitching venture capitalists to invest in Airbnb, one of the people he consulted was the entrepreneur and investor Sam Altman, who later became the president of the Y Combinator Startup Accelerator. Altman saw Chesky's pitch deck and told him it was perfect, except that he needed to change the market size slide from a modest $30 million to $30 billion. "Investors want bees, baby," Altman told Chesky. Of course, Altman wasn't telling Chesky to lie. Rather, he argued that if the Airbnb team truly believed in their own assumptions, $30 million was a gross underestimate, and they should use a number that was true to their convictions. As it turns out, Airbnb's market was indeed closer to $30 billion. When evaluating market size, it's also critical to try to account for how lower costs and product improvements can expand markets by appealing to new customers, in addition to seizing market share from existing players. In 2014, Aswath Damodaran, a professor of finance at NYU's Stern School of Business, estimated that Uber was probably worth roughly $6 billion, based on its ability to ultimately win 10% of the global taxi market of $100 billion, or $10 billion. According to Uber's own projections, in 2016, the company processed over $26 billion in payments. It's safe to say that $10 billion was a serious underestimate, as the ease of use and lower cost of Uber and its competitors expanded the market for transportation as a service. As Aaron Levy, the founder of the online file storage company Box, noted in a tweet in 2014, sizing the market for a disruptor based on an incumbent's market is like sizing a car industry off how many horses there were in 1910. The other factor that can lead to underestimating a market is neglecting to account for expanding into additional markets. Amazon began as Amazon Books, the Earth's biggest bookstore. But Jeff Bezos always intended for bookselling to serve as a beachhead from which Amazon could expand outward to encompass his massive vision of the everything store. Today, Amazon dominates the bookselling industry, but thanks to relentless market expansion, book sales represent less than 7% of Amazon's total sales. The same effect can be seen in the financial results of Apple. In the first quarter of 2017, Apple generated $7.2 billion from the sale of personal computers, a category the company pioneered and once dominated. That's a great number, to be sure, but over that same financial quarter, Apple's total revenue was a whopping $78.4 billion, which meant that Apple's original market accounted for less than 10% of its total sales. My Greylock colleague, Jerry Chen, who helped Diane Greene scale VMware's virtualization software into a massive business, likes to point out, every billion-dollar business started as a $10 million business. But whether you are creating a new market, expanding an existing market, or relying on adjacent markets to get to those Bs that investors want, baby, you need to have a plausible path to get from here to there. This leads us to one of my favorite growth factors to discuss with entrepreneurs. Distribution. Growth factor number two, distribution. The second growth factor needed for a strong, scalable business is distribution. Many people in Silicon Valley like to focus on building products that are, in the famous words of the late Steve Jobs, insanely great. Great products are certainly a positive. We'll discuss the lack of product quality as a growth limiter later on. But the cold and unromantic fact is that a good product with great distribution will almost always beat a great product with poor distribution. Dropbox is a company with a great product, but it succeeded because of its great distribution. In an interview for Reed's Masters of Scale podcast, founder and CEO Drew Houston said that he believes that too many startups overlook the importance of distribution. Most of the orthodoxy in Silicon Valley is about building a good product. I think that's because most companies in the Valley don't survive beyond the building the product phase. You have to be good at building a product, then you have to be just as good at getting users, then you have to be just as good at building a business model. If you're missing any of the links in the chain, the whole chain is broken. The challenge of distribution has become even greater in the mobile-first era. Unlike the web, where search engine optimization and email links were broadly applicable and successful distribution channels, mobile app stores offer little opportunity for serendipitous product discovery. When you go to Apple's or Google's app store, you're searching for a specific product. Few people install apps just for the hell of it. As a result, the business model innovators who have succeeded, e.g., Instagram, WhatsApp, Snap, have had to find creative ways to get broad distribution for their product, without spending a lot of money. These distribution techniques fall into two general categories, leveraging existing networks and virality. A. Leveraging existing networks. New companies rarely have the reach or resources to simply pour money into advertising campaigns. Instead, they have to find creative ways to tap into existing networks to distribute their products. When I was at PayPal, one of the major vehicles for distribution of our payment service was settling purchases on eBay. At the time, eBay was already one of the largest players in e-commerce, and by the beginning of 2000, already had 10 million registered users. We tapped into this user base by building software that made it extremely easy for eBay sellers to automatically add a Pay with PayPal button to all of their eBay listings. The amazing thing is that customers did so even though eBay had its own rival payment service, BillPoint. But sellers were required to add BillPoint manually to each of their listings. PayPal did it for them. Many years later, Airbnb was able to perform a similar feat by leveraging the online classified service, Craigslist. Based on a suggestion from Y Combinator's Michael Seibel, Airbnb built a system that allowed and encouraged its hosts to cross-post their listings to the much larger Craigslist. Hosts were told, reposting your listing from Airbnb to Craigslist increases your earnings by $500 per month on average, and were allowed to do so by clicking a single button. This took serious technology skills. Unlike many platforms, Craigslist doesn't have an application programming interface, API, that allows other software to interact with it. But it was technology innovation for the purposes of distribution innovation, not product innovation. It was kind of a novel approach, Airbnb founder Nathan Blitchartzik said of the integration. No other site had that slick an integration. It was quite successful for us. Leveraging an existing network can have downsides, of course. What the existing network gives, or unknowingly allows to be taken, the existing network can also take away. Zynga, the leading social games company, achieved great success leveraging Facebook for distribution, but had to dramatically re-engineer its distribution model after Facebook decided to stop allowing people playing Zynga games to post their progress to their Facebook friends. Disclosure. I am a member of Zynga's board of directors. Zynga founder Mark Pincus was far-sighted enough to build a strong enough franchise to survive the change. In contrast, so-called content farms like Demand Media that leveraged Google search platform to generate website traffic and advertising revenues never recovered after Google tuned its algorithms to deprioritize content from what it called junk websites. Despite these dangers, leveraging existing networks can be a critical part of a business model, especially if these networks can provide a booster rocket that is later supplemented with virality or network effects. B. Virality. Viral distribution occurs when the users of a product bring more users, and those users bring additional users, and so on, much like an infectious virus spreads from host to host. Virality can either be organic, occurring during the course of normal usage of the product, or incentivized by some kind of reward. After launching LinkedIn, the team and I devoted significant time and energy to figuring out how to improve organic virality. That is, how to make it easier for existing users to invite friends to use the service. One way we did this was to refine what have become some of the standard tools of virality, such as address book importers. For example, we built software that allowed LinkedIn to connect to our users' Outlook contacts, which made it very easy for them to invite their most important connections. But equally important was an unanticipated source of virality. As it turned out, users wanted to use their LinkedIn pages as their primary professional identity on the internet. Having a page like this to point others to, with all the details of their professional life together in one place, generated value not only for the user, but for the people viewing the page, and it made viewers realize that they should get their own LinkedIn profile. As a result, we added public profiles as a systematic tool to boost both the member value proposition and our viral growth rate. At PayPal, we combined organic and incentivized virality. The payment product was inherently viral. If someone emailed you money using PayPal, you had to set up an account to get paid. But we enhanced this organic virality with monetary incentives. If you referred a friend to PayPal, you got $10, and your friend got $10. This combination of organic and incentivized virality allowed PayPal to grow 7 to 10% per day. As the PayPal network grew, we reduced the incentives to $5 and $5, then finally eliminated them altogether. Incentives don't have to be monetary. Like PayPal, Dropbox used a similar combination of organic virality, as users share files with non-users, and incentivized virality. Basic account holders get 500 megabytes of extra storage per user they refer. Pro account holders get 1 gigabyte. To grow. Even though Dropbox invested in partnerships with leading PC makers like Dell, Drew Houston credits virality with driving the company's rapid growth, helping it double its 100,000 users at launch to 200,000 users just 10 days later, then skyrocket to 1 million users just 7 months after that. If your distribution strategy focuses on virality, you also have to focus on retention. Bringing new users in through the front door doesn't help you grow if they immediately turn around and leave. According to Houston, Dropbox discovered this truth the hard way when activation rates revealed that only 40% of the people signing up were actually putting files in their Dropbox and linking them to their computers. In an interview for my Masters of Scale podcast, Drew described a scene reminiscent of the television show Silicon Valley, but with a happier ending. What we did is we went on Craigslist and offered